Bumblecast. I'm your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and with me is the HD remake, but still faithful to the original, Kyle JCRB Krause.
I have been remade, I have been reborn, but I am the same. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing just fine. How are you, sir?
Good. Have you been HD remade yet?
No. I still have the scan lines. Heaven help you can find a Betamax that actually plays me.
Okay.
I'm more of a collector's item.
That's cool. It makes sense. They only made like 1,000 of you. Meanwhile, they've made millions and millions of me. So,
right. Makes sense. I don't have any actual value, but I'm so rare that people say I do.
Oh, is that how these things work?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's a collector's market in a nutshell.
I guess that might be true. Yeah, these things really don't have value unless you say they do. So, yeah.
Well, there was something on the news just the other day that a copy of E.T. on the Atari sold for some obscene amount of money. I don't remember how many zeros were attached to it. But it's because you can't find E.T. anymore because they buried it out in the desert. But it's not a good game. You don't want to play it. Nobody really wants it, but it's so rare that therefore it must have value.
There must have been something special about it. It must have been like still new sealed or something, or it was one of those junkyard ones.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. One of those, not junkyard ones, the dump ones. One of the ones they dug up out of the dump. Because those are going for a little bit, but the... I think just a loose E.T. cartridge isn't worth that much. But I don't know. I've seen boxed, new in-box copies that were of sticker-sealed Super Mario Brothers for the NES that went for thousands of dollars. So
yeah, but that's an icon.
And also, that's a sticker-sealed first-run, first-print U.S. release, released during the test run that Nintendo had in the New York area when they were first looking at launching the NES here before they even went nationwide. So that makes some sense. That's like a pretty rare game. The game itself, obviously not that rare, but that particular variant of it, pretty rare. So makes some sense.
Also in the news concerning Nintendo, they announced the Switch Lite. If you don't want to have the convenience of playing on your TV and on the go, you can just have a giant Game Boy.
Or an unfolding DS, 3DS. Actually, both.
Now with one screen.
Yep. Only one screen, yeah. For those of you who want both a phone and a game machine, but you want them separated... You don't want to just play games on your phone. It's fine.
So, did you enjoy playing such games as ARMS using the Joy-Cons? Well, too bad. There are no Joy-Cons on the Switch Lite. This thing is a solid unit, but you can laugh at the original Switch owners because you have an actual D-pad.
Yes. And you can also get separate Joy-Cons. And play it that way. But you have a little tiny screen. You have to prop it up somewhere. And it doesn't have a kickstand on it. So you have to figure that out. You have to figure out how to get it to stand up on its own. Have fun with that. It's a little mini game that comes with the Switch. You don't even have
Nintendo,
to think about it.
One step forward, two steps back.
Yeah, well, I'm not too surprised this was happening. It was like the worst kept secret in video games for a couple months there. It's like, Nintendo Switch Lite, huh? All right, well, we kind of knew about that. Yeah, good job, Nintendo. We just didn't know what colors it was coming in. That's about all we didn't know. We also got a quiet refresh of the original Nintendo Switch. I'm actually kind of surprised Nintendo even made an announcement about it. I kind of thought it was going to end up being a silent refresh because there were some rumors that there was going to be a refreshed Switch that's using the variant of the CPU that's in the Nintendo Switch Lite, and it sounds like that's what they're doing. It's going to also have improved battery life, just to stick the knife a little harder into the people who already own one.
Yeah. Those of us who hunted and paid premium to find one,
Are we really surprised, though? This happens all the time. There's always...
Oh, God, no. And there's, it doesn't really bug me because...
And it's not Nintendo... I'm not... This is not a, just a Nintendo thing. They've all... All the console makers have done this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once Project Scarlet comes out, I give it 6 months before Scarlet 2. But I'm not personally that irked because we never undock the Switch anyway.
I don't either.
Like, 9 times out of 10, maybe Aaliyah will play it if I want to do something off of the PS4 or if she wants to, you know, game in bed before going to sleep. I leave it right there because I don't like the way the Switch feels in my hands. I don't like the weight of it. I don't like the design of it. And I can't see the screen. It's too small for my old man eyes. So
I just don't like the Joy-Cons.
No.
I really don't.
I'll give the Joy-Cons credit. They work better than I thought they would, but they're still not comfortable for me to use.
Nah. And they're $80 freaking. Like, what the heck?
Well, you got to pay for that HD rumble, man.
It's so good. Listen, if it were just a regular freaking motor, vibration motor, it doesn't matter. It would be feel exactly the same. There's nothing special about it. They don't do anything special with it. It's another one of those weird unused features that Nintendo just, like, oh yeah, they just make it vibrate just like every other freaking controller. It's fine. I actually don't like the way the vibration feels. It's too, like, I don't know, sharp? It's weird. I don't like it in the Pro Controller either. There's something about it that's just like kind of like that. It's a vibration. It's the kind of vibration that makes my hand tingle, and not in a good way. I don't like it. Don't like it at all. So
maybe I automatically shut mine off because I can't think of mine rumbling at all except to turn it on.
No, it does. Or at least it should. Or it, unless yours is broken, but yours might be an improvement broken then.
It's not broken, it's a feature.
Speaking of controllers, actually, we are returning to Kyle's controller corner this week because I have played with a new controller finally. So I thought I'd give my quick thoughts on it. A new controller from Retrobit called the Tribute 64. If you're familiar with the Nintendo 64 controller from Hori, the mini pad that was put out, I believe it was put out in Japan around the same time as the N64 was actually a thing. This is essentially a third-party recreation of it. So this is a third-party recreation of a third-party controller, which is kind of funny. We're getting multiple levels deep here. We need to go deeper. It was official.
If the center six stops twirling, you know that it's a dream.
The original controller was officially licensed, but it was still a third-party controller by Hori, and it's actually a pretty good controller to use. I was kind of surprised. It's more of a traditional style. You know, the N64 controller, Ian, is weird and has sort of a three-pronged design that no other controller has ever duplicated. For
I am fairly certain everyone pretended it was a weird spaceship at some point.
Yeah, it's like a three
or Wolverine claws or size from Raphael. I mean, the possibilities are endless.
True. It's an interesting design that didn't quite catch on. I wonder why. But Hori's approach was a little bit more traditional. It was a two-pronged joystick. The joystick itself is actually a bit more GameCube style instead of N64 style. So it has sort of a dome shape instead of just a big stick sticking up out of the middle of a concave bowl.
Less likely to stab your palm.
Yeah. And it feels pretty good. And the design of it has the L and R as regular shoulder buttons. And then as like where L2 and R2 would be, it duplicates the Z button, which is an interesting design. It works pretty well for games like Mario 64, which I played pretty extensively with it, and it works really well for that. Shooters, for GoldenEye and stuff, it works good for. The one game that I really kind of struggled with that design in particular was F-Zero X.
Huh.
Since F-Zero X requires you to lean the car to turn, with the R and Z buttons. It doesn't require it, but highly recommended. Trying to use the upper R trigger when you want to turn left, and then the lower Z trigger when you want to turn, or sorry, when you want to turn right, and then the lower Z trigger when you want to turn left. It takes some time to get used to that.
And you can't remap where the buttons go?
No, because you would think like, oh, you can use the L and R buttons to lean the car in F-Zero. But no, you can't use the L button. The L button was originally not accessible on the regular controller, so they didn't expect you to be able to be able to hit it easily.
That's true.
So the L button does nothing. You have to hit the Z trigger and the R trigger to kind of lean the car, and then to do the twist attacks and stuff like that in F-Zero X. So that's a little awkward. I thought the alignment of the A and B buttons would be weird, but I was surprised to find that I actually got used to it very quickly. You do have to move your thumb down a little bit more than I expected from where it would naturally rest, but it still works out pretty well. The C buttons work fine, and the D-pad's also pretty easily accessible because it's right there in the middle of the controller. So any game that actually uses any D-pad functions, it works nicely for. I didn't try it with like a 2D game. Like, I didn't try Mischief Makers or anything. Maybe I should have. Something that uses the D-pad. But if you got a game that uses the D-pad for any other functions, it's quick and easily accessible. You don't have to move your hand over out from the stick and move it over or try and reach across with your right hand or anything like that. So it's a pretty cool little controller. And I was overall pretty pleased with it. I think I'll be using it to play most N64 games from now on, probably. It's got a good build quality, not too bad. And for the price, it's worth trying out if you get the chance. I'd recommend it overall, unless you're like hardcore into racing games that require the Z and R buttons, then it might get a little awkward. But other than that, check it out. Retrobit Tribute 64. I liked it. So, we do have a quick update, Ian, about the show. Quick update about the show. The Bumblecast is now available on Spotify.
Ah, yes. If you are a Spotify person, you can find us there.
Yes. If you like listening to things on Spotify, search Bumblecast and you'll find it. It is there for your listening enjoyment. It should be all the episodes going back to episode one that are up there now. So go back and listen if you are ever so inclined. And we're also on Google Play. Don't forget about that. And what else are we on, Ian? We are on Apple Podcasts. There we go.
There we go.
Yeah. So, yep. But it's all up there for you to listen to. Are we ready to get into our main topic?
Just one quick confession. You had me flashing back to when we were playing the N64 on the official controller.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize you were supposed to hold the middle tine. So for most of my N64 life, I was holding the left hook and reaching across. Over.
Yeah. There were a lot of people that were doing that.
So, once I figured out that was wrong, I can't hold it the proper way. So goodbye, N64. You had a great library, but a confusing controller. But yes, anyway, let's move on to the main topic.
That's why you need that Tribute 64 controller. It works really well for that. It just works really well as a standard style controller. It makes some, you have to make some concessions for the design. It feels a little small, so your hands are real close together, but you get used to it eventually. It works well though. I was rather pleased.
Alrighty, so today's topic comes to us from patron Scruffy Matt, asking us what's our opinion on remakes, reboots, and remasters of movies and TV shows.
Yeah,
we're kind of casting a broad net here.
Yes, we did. We did this regarding video games, and now I think it's time to look at movies and TV. I would say that remasters of movies and TV shows are interesting. There aren't many. The only ones I can really think of are like re-releases that are in HD or 4K, except for Star Wars. It's the only one I can think of that's like actually a remaster where they went back and changed stuff. But
and most of the time, the remasters and the touch-ups are better for the most part. You know, vibrant. They kind of pop more. It makes you feel like, oh, I'm watching this again for the first time.
Sometimes it makes things more obvious, like things like Star Trek, when you watch them originally on like a cheap, crappy TV from the time they were made or even through the 90s, it wasn't nearly as obvious that something was fake, or like makeup wasn't nearly as obvious because they weren't expecting you to have sort of the definition of of the people to be able to actually see what's going on. So
and then you have animated shows that are done on the cheap, or they didn't have the original cells anymore to be touched up. So they do some very slapdash digital touch-ups, and it just kind of looks eh. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but I know that there was something that came out that everyone was looking forward to a lot. It was one of those programs, one of those pillars of media, and it was just disappointing how much they didn't do for it.
A lot of those early episodes of The Simpsons are they don't upscale very well. Because they weren't designed to be upscaled like that, so they look a little muddy, and they don't look great. So, yeah, but then again, the art style of earlier Simpsons episodes is also a lot more, I would say, like vibrant and interesting, rather than kind of the sterilized designs that we have today, where they're not quite so rubbery, they don't move around as much. It's a little more. The animation's a bit more precise these days, so I guess it just kind of depends on your preference and what you prefer and how you prefer watching it, or what time period you prefer watching The Simpsons. So, but that's one of the ones I can think of where they kind of did the best they could with the re-release, sort of a remaster. They weren't able to quite pull off a remaster just because of the way the show was made even at the time. So,
and Star Trek, Star Wars,
Star Trek would be the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Star Wars, yeah, Star Wars is the big one, I would say, in the remaster realm.
And not to be one of those guys, but I feel like most of the additions that were made, not the touch-ups, the touch-ups were nice. It made it, you know, as I said, more bright and colorful and vibrant. It made it feel more alive. But the additions, for the most part, were either wholly unnecessary or did not age well.
No.
I mean, there's something charming about the practical effects. You know, the little puppets that pop up. It's like, that's a puppet. But it still looks like a thing in the environment.
Right.
Not the giant rhinoceros elephant thing. And, it pooped. That's funny.
the Star Wars Special Edition was kind of an interesting precursor to the prequels, in that we probably should have seen the prequels coming based on what they did to the original trilogy.
Oh, those slowly blinking Ewoks
and the little jizz number in the first movie that they added in the cantina.
I need to specify, because we were discussing this earlier and I was like, Kyle, what are you talking about? It is an actual in-universe term. It's not jazz.
It's called jizz. Look up, go to Wikipedia and look up jizz.
Specifically Wikipedia. Don't Google it.
Not Google it. Yeah, don't go anywhere else and look that up. Just go to Wikipedia. Go to the Star Wars, official Star Wars wiki, and look it up.
And then it messes with the story, too, because
it does. Yeah.
They added a scene in A New Hope where they blow up Alderaan, and it shows Jar Jar on Alderaan. So, Jar Jar gets blown up. Except when you go and watch, Revenge of the Sith, you see Jar Jar, except he's older and he looks completely different. So within its own continuity, they flubbed it. And that's just lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And they really did. There's also, I'm trying to think of what else they did. Oh, like the ring around the explosion. Actually,
that one I don't completely mind.
I don't really mind that either. I mean, we have established that space does not work the same way as it does in real life in the Star Wars universe. So that's perfectly fine. But it's just kind of, it seems kind of unnecessary. But again, it's kind of a, it's also kind of a cool look to it where it like whooshes by you and you have that sound coming at you in the theater. So that's kind of cool. But I kind of get that one, but it's still pretty unnecessary. You don't need it, but it's, that's actually kind of neat. So. But
that and the change, the ending to Return of the Jedi, where they actually show the galaxy celebrating the fall of the Empire rather than just Yub Nub on Endor, that I think is a nice addition. It gives you a sense of the scale of the universe, even though we've been, galaxy, which is far, far away, when we've had a very, you know, intimate look for most of the trilogy. So that is a good addition, even if the song was awful.
Yeah, we don't talk about the song. But I do agree it kind of helps fill out the world a little bit and makes the galaxy seem more alive, even if it's, you know, not super great in the end. That's really it there. I kind of like that they added the deleted scene in A New Hope with Han and Jabba. But it doesn't make any sense. There's no reason for it to be there. There's a reason why it got cut. And the effect,
I didn't like it because it doesn't and the effect, convey the characters properly.
Not really. And the effect of Han stepping up behind Jabba just looks terrible.
Yeah.
It looks really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they tried, but it looks bad. So, and Jabba doesn't look anything in that like he did in the third movie either. So it's like, what? Why is he different? Why does he have a different design? Why is his skin different? Why does he move different? Oh, it's because he's a computer in this one. While in the third movie, he's actually a real practical effect. He's a real puppet suit thingy. That's why it looks different. So, yeah, really not necessary. But my first time seeing the original Star Wars was in theaters, so I have to give it some credit for that. It was still fun as a kid to go see it in an actual theater and have that be my first experience with the movie. But I'd say overall, it's the changes were pretty unnecessary.
Moving on to where do you draw the line between a remake and a reboot?
That's tough. Sometimes they're both. Like James Bond, I think, goes through, I don't know, like not really remakes, but sort of periodic reboots, but they're still sometimes in continuity. I don't know.
Yeah. It's Bond, I didn't even want to touch because that's just a mess. I was thinking.
Yeah, Bond is a bit of a mess.
Recent cinematic Star Trek movies, which are very clearly reboots, but they are also in continuity. And I liked that gesture, at least with the first film, because it didn't invalidate all that came before. If you watched original Star Trek and all of that up to this point, that still happened. That was still yours. It's still just as canon. But here are the new movies forging their own path, except when they're just cribbing the old stories. But that's a different topic. And, you know, here's the new direction. Enjoy this as well. And I liked that.
Yeah, I think it's okay if it's like maybe acknowledged being an alternate universe, which was kind of neat because it meant they could dig into the other universes. They could dig into, actually specifically into the mainline universe and pull out certain characters and pull them into the new stuff without changing anything. So they could pull like old Spock through into an alternate timeline and have him just be there. And it's like, hey, cool, it's old Spock. I don't know. It's kind of cool. I like that. But I mean, it's tough. It's tough to say if I like that overall or not. I kind of fell off after the second movie. I'm like, oh, so they're just doing Wrath of Khan again. Great. And they're doing it worse. It's not even as good.
The third one was fun.
It's not even as good. I didn't see the third one. I heard it was actually pretty good. Okay.
I wouldn't say it was great, but it was fun. It was entertaining.
Okay. Well, that's kind of how I felt about the first one. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was entertaining. And the second one had its moments too, but then once I realized it was just Wrath of Khan again, I'm like, well, crap. We already had Wrath of Khan, and it was better than this. We don't need this.
And really, who can hold a candle to Ricardo Montalban?
No, yeah, exactly. I don't care. I don't care how many English. I don't care how English you are, and how many syllables your name has. You're not going to be able to hold a candle to Ricardo Montalban. No, there's no way. There's no way.
And I guess the other big one for folks lately are the Disney live action, or at least Disney with a higher production budget remakes, because The Lion King is not a live action movie. It is an animated movie.
I literally have no interest in any of these. I have not had an interest in them since they started doing them with like the, what was the first one? Was it Maleficent the first one they did, or one of the first ones they did? At least that sort of changed the perspective of the story, as far as I'm aware. But
yeah,
it was still kind of like, why?
It had some neat visuals. It kind of dragged in places. It was all right. Beauty and the Beast, I think was their second one, and I had no interest in that because I really, really did not like the designs.
No,
you lost all the whimsy by having the enchanted objects look like actual objects instead of cartoon characters.
Right.
I passed on Aladdin because the CG for Will Smith's genie was just atrocious. But
it just looks not great. Like
I've heard mixed things that that you can go, if you're not a snob and you go in and you just want a fun movie, it's fun. But for other folks who really, really held Aladdin dear to their hearts, I have not heard anything good. So, and it was Lion King.
Yeah,
everything I've heard so far is that it looks absolutely gorgeous, but it's a pale retelling of the same movie. There's nothing new brought to the table that's good, aside from the stellar voice cast. The music is weaker. The emotive ability of the animals is not there.
Yeah, that's very noticeable, especially for the Hakuna Matata bit.
Big romantic number, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, takes place during the day.
You did it, Disney. Perfect. You win.
And then they've got, I think next up on the list is Mulan, which from what I'm hearing is skewing closer to the original fable, and thus is nothing like the Disney movie, which took massive liberties with it. So it might be interesting in its own right, but being that it's going to be compared to the original Mulan, that's going to drag it down. And then it was recently announced that Treasure Planet is getting the live action treatment.
What? Okay, what?
Now, I'm one of the, 10 people in the world who really loved Treasure Planet. Unironically, I love that movie. I think it gets a bad rap. But
That's a very weird one to dig out of the vault. That's weird.
Maybe they figure nobody likes Treasure Planet, so that's a safe one.
Jeez, I never even...
Oh, man, they're getting so mad about all these other ones. Let's do one they hated.
Okay, 2002.
Next up, live-action Fox and the Hound.
2002. Yeah, I never saw that one, actually. Yeah. Huh.
It has its problems. It certainly does. But, I really like that one.
At this rate, are they going to end up doing, a live-action version of just Tangled? It's like only a couple of years ago that one came out. But now they're going to just do a live-action version of that? It's like, what? Why? Stop. And then they'll do a live-action version of Tarzan, and we'll be like, well, that would just be a Tarzan movie, so what are you doing? Why are you making that? Oh, I'm doing a live-action version of the Disney animated version of Tarzan. Well, all right, that's just Tarzan.
We have to go deeper.
And then we're going to start bringing out Lilo and Stitch, and it's like, you realize the point of Lilo and Stitch is that it's a lovely children's story that has a wacky character that you really can't recreate in a sort of a live action environment. Right?
No, they're not going to touch Lilo and Stitch. I will burn Florida to the ground before they touch Lilo and Stitch.
Okay, as long as you're not burning Hawaii to the ground.
No.
Okay, good.
Hawaii has nothing to do with this.
Okay. Well,
except everything.
Yeah, I know. Look at Hawaii. I don't know what you did. But you did something, Hawaii.
Now, here's a question for you.
I blame Florida. Florida's more likely. Anyway, what's up? Go ahead.
The various Ninja Turtle animated series. Aha. Would you count those as reboots?
They kind of act like it.
Because
the 2012 version definitely had a reboot. Definitely retold the story of... Like, it started pretty much at the beginning and retold the story of the Turtles and didn't really consider anything other than its own lore outside of, like, doing references or things inspired by other Turtle stuff. So, I would say the 2012 at least was a reboot. I don't know about 2003 because I didn't watch it. And
it, too,
anything
did its
that.
Own thing. It did its own origin story. It did the whole shebang.
Okay. I would say those are kind of reboot-esque.
See, I almost don't want to say that because they stand alone as their own, you know, version of the Turtles. But that's the thing. They're taking a known property, remixing its elements, and releasing it in a new format. So isn't that basically a remake? That is a reboot?
Yeah.
You're taking a premise, you're starting it over, you're putting your own spin on it. That's a reboot.
Technically, yes.
I don't know. It feels weird to think of that as a reboot to me for some reason.
But they're remade for the audience, for a newer audience that they're anticipating to hit. So that's what reboots usually do. That's usually the reason for reboots is either for rights issues or to just use previous ideas or previous characters and retool them for a new audience. So I would say that those are reboots. Yeah, technically. Sure. I would say maybe even the 89 cartoon was a reboot of the comics.
Yep, definitely.
Technically.
Considering how much liberty it took with it.
Yeah, very, on a very technical level, yeah, it would be a reboot of it. Because it's
and
very
Rise
different.
Rise of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is doing its own thing way off the beaten path, so...
Yeah, it's very different. So technically a reboot. But I don't know. It's not like... Turtles as a property has pretty much existed constantly since the mid-80s. So it's I understand what you mean when you say it's kind of weird to call it a reboot because it's always been around. Meanwhile, you have things like She-Ra, where we haven't seen a She-Ra cartoon since the original one in the 80s, and it took them 30 years to make another one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot more definitively a reboot, whereas Turtles has gone through multiple incarnations and retools and reboots over the years to be something different, so...
I put She-Ra on my list of shows to mention, but I feel like I don't have the best position on it because I don't really remember original She-Ra. I know I watched it because I remember thinking, why is she not crossing over with He-Man? Holy crap, this would be amazing if they went on adventures together.
Yeah.
Because they were basically the same show, just with a different gender bias. But it would they were there. They kind of overlapped, and it was a rights issue, which is stupid. And it would have been cool. So, but have you seen the new reboot of She-Ra?
Yeah, we did the review on it for the show.
Oh yeah. I still haven't gotten to season two.
I actually haven't gotten any further beyond where we were in that review, but I remember liking it. I liked the show. So, but yeah. I don't remember enough of the original either to really compare.
On the other hand, you have Thundercats, which...
You know this better than I do.
Kyle, I'm still bitter about Thundercats. Because the original show is such a wonderfully bizarre science fantasy premise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, it was a glorified toy commercial. Let's not mince words here, but it was so weird and so uniquely itself that it endured in the popular memory for a reason.
Right.
And the reboot started off so strongly. It looked at what came before and said, okay, what if this was actually driven by a plot line and characters rather than a toy line? You know? Let's integrate the characters in a more interesting, tightly knit way. Let's build the world around it so it feels like Third Earth is a world with multiple cultures and not just here's a random samurai because that toy came out. And the pilot, or I should say the season opener, is just phenomenal to get the feeling of Thundera and the culture of the cats and everything about it. I ate it up. It was just stupendous. Phenomenal voice cast. Great design. Loved it, loved it, loved it. And then the rest of the show was a garbage fire that just got worse and worse as it went on. Just the logical gaffes were baffling. Like, I wanted to go back in time and just kick in the door of the writer's room and go, what are you thinking? No! And then they drew me back in because they did a kind of flashback episode that explained the origins of Third Earth. And they threw in little nods to Silverhawks and Tiger Sharks and other stuff that was in that vein. It's like, oh my god, they're pulling it all together. My childhood is being reborn. And then they messed it up again. And just, it was so bad. And then I think it was the lead showrunner or somebody involved released notes on what was going to happen for season two, and it was only going to get worse.
Oh no.
Like, it was a litany of bad fanfic ideas, one after the other, and I was kind of glad the show was put out of its misery. It's just, oh, Kyle, it was so stupendously badly written, and it hurts because everything else about it was so good. Except for the toys. They look kind of cheap. But that's not the point. The show, Kyle. The show.
Just a big missed opportunity, huh? I feel like Transformers is much like Ninja Turtles, where it's kind of always existed in some form. So
true.
To say that things are rebooting is weird. But Transformers has been, I guess, rebooted multiple times. Unless there are things about it that take place in the same continuity. I actually am not that well-versed on Transformers lore, so I don't know.
But I've not gotten deep into it myself, but from what I've picked up, there is a kind of universal continuity that is really messy. So unless you want a deep dive, don't even tread in those waters.
Yeah. My knowledge of Transformers goes to, like, Generation 1 and the movie, the 80s movie, and a little bit of Beast Wars. And that's about where my knowledge of it sort of ends. Other than the movies, which those are definitely reboots, and we don't talk about those. No. Unless I hear Bumblebee was all right.
Right.
But other than that.
Side note, because you brought up Transformers in the movie, did you hear about the Unicron that they debuted at San Diego Comic-Con?
No, I have not heard about that yet.
This fellow is virtually to scale, is 19 pounds, in robot form, stands 27 inches tall, Kyle.
Oh, boy.
And in planet mode has a diameter of, I think it said 30 inches.
Holy crap.
And comes with a stand to put the planet form on, because that thing is not going to just sit on the floor.
No, that's a nice rolling, that's like a nice beach ball right there.
That thing, someone's going to get hurt.
A very heavy beach ball. Yeah. That sounds pretty
good. Apparently has working eyes and a working jaw and posable fingers, so you can, like, grab the puny things and stuff them into his mouth and just, I don't know, it is super indulgent nerdery and I love it.
That sounds great. I like that a lot. Oh man. Well, actually, talking about, like, cartoon reboots and stuff, do we want to delve into the Sonic side of things? Of, like, how we had two concurrent, different, very different cartoons running at the same time. That's rare even today.
Yeah, I mean, it does not happen. You almost think of it as, like, Sat-A-M kind of coming after Adventures of, just because they were so tonally dissonant.
Right.
But they were concurrent, like you said. And how did that even get approved? Where was the budget to run two totally separate cartoons with wildly different voice casts for the most part?
Yeah, Sonic was the only consistent voice between the two, wasn't he? Because Tails' voice was Tails' voice the same between both? I thought he was different. But maybe not.
It's been so long.
But maybe not. But yeah, that's pretty wild to have two concurrent cartoons happening at the same time that are very different, but they're the same franchise.
And then you had Underground that so desperately was an attempt to get Sat AM back up and running.
It was sort of a continuation slash spinoff of Sat AM. Interestingly,
it was supposed to be the sequel, and then upper management meddling kind of changed course until it became uniquely Sonic Underground. The only vestiges you have are Robotnik's design and the pilot showing off the devastation of Mobotropolis. There's a statue of King Acorn, but that's all that survived. Otherwise, it is wholly its own thing.
Okay.
There's Uncle Chuck. I guess there's Uncle Chuck.
Uncle Chuck's in it. Okay. And then from there, Sonic cartoons kind of went away for a while.
Yeah, and then we got Sonic X, which...
Yep.
That's a mixed bag.
Also, if Sonic X also would be like a reboot, it's an offshoot. It's very different from the previous cartoons.
Influence from Sega Japan.
Yeah, not even made in the same country. It was an anime, so made in Japan. And then after that, we had Sonic Boom. Again, a very different take on the series. A little bit more in line with, Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. Kinda, in terms of it just being kind of a silly, fun show.
Yeah, I mean...
But obviously, nowhere connected to it at all.
No, and I think the strength of Boom is that it tried to do its own thing.
Right.
You know?
I agree.
I feel like everything else up to that was a tie-in into Sonic. This was us trying to do Sonic this way, and none of them really worked for various reasons. And Boom said, "We're not Sonic, we're Sonic Boom. Look at us be Seinfeld, but with furries." And it worked. It was an action comedy, mostly a comedy, and it was delightful.
Yeah. I would say Sat AM worked and holds up pretty well. But it has its problems, but I'd say overall that, especially at the time where we had two very different Sonic cartoons, if you want to compare the two, the ones that hold up better, Sat AM is definitely the one that holds up between the two.
And there's
certain aspects of the show that endured for decades afterward. So
right.
it definitely contributed a lot to the overall franchise.
Here's my thing with Sat AM. It's a great show.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a product of its time.
Well, yeah.
The thing is, it's not a great Sonic show.
I think I get you.
Look at the environments. There's no checkered pattern hills. There's no bright, vibrant environments. There's no weird and wacky terrain. No loop-de-loops, no flying platforms. You have dreary factories and natural-looking forest and mesas and valleys and the occasional odd thing, but it's mostly very mundane, realistic terrain.
I gotta be honest, I kind of like Sonic in that sort of universe, though. I don't know.
See, that makes me think Sonic 06, and...
True.
That was a... No. And, you know, the story is fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with the Freedom Fighters. There's nothing wrong with Sally or her premise. You know, a princess deposed of her kingdom fighting back with a handful of rebels from the Force. That's a fantastic story. That's great. There's a reason why it endured for so long.
Right.
But that's Sally's story. Sat AM is Sally's story. She is trying to get back her birthright to protect her people. It's just Robotnik happens to be the antagonist and Sonic happens to be part of the cast.
It's a good point. Okay. I kind of get you.
So in that's why I say it's not a great Sonic story, because it's Sally's story. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if it was, you know, the show was Sally and the Freedom Fighters, it would still be a great 90s cartoon.
Yeah, if Sonic weren't in it, I think it could have still worked. You don't really need Sonic, even though his name sold the show. That's what got me to watch it. I probably wouldn't have watched it otherwise.
See, this is why I can't completely write off Adventures of, because
right.
At its absolute core, it is the quintessential Sonic cartoon. Sonic and Tails going through these crazy environments, rescuing people from Dr. Eggman, Dr. Robotnik's latest evil scheme. But, you know, it's got this really, like, almost G-rated Ren and Stimpy feel to some of the sight gags. You've got tired old Saturday Night Live bits just ripped wholesale.
The tone is very off for what you would expect Sonic
it's
to
bootleg
be.
Bootleg Looney Tunes. I will take Sad AM over Adventures of any day of the week.
Absolutely.
Bar none.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, you think we've gone full circle on this topic and have to restart and reboot it all over again?
Throughout the recording, we're going to start from scratch.
Yep. We have to reboot this whole episode because we just did it. So now we got to do it again. I'm just kidding. Are we ready to move on?
Let's move on to the Q&A.
All righty. If you want to ask us questions, head on over to your email client and type in bumblecast@yahoo.com. Or head on over to your Twitter client and type in @bumblecast. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, scroll down into the YouTube comments and type your question down there. Or if you're on Patreon, ask your Patreon questions via a comment or a message anywhere there, and I'll usually see it. If I don't see it, let me know if I missed your question, especially if you're a patron. And we also have a chat on Discord where you can ask your questions too. So if you want to hang out in the Discord, become a patron at patreon.com/bumblecast. All right, got that plug out of the way. Got our cheap plug in there. Let's go ahead and get into Scruffy Matt.
You mean the priority Q&A?
Like I said, Scruffy Matt. He says, "Hey, fellas, I've got a potentially rage-inducing question for you this week. What is that one game you have been nearly driven to madness by because you can never achieve higher than a 99% completion rate or are missing just one single achievement from it? Banjo-Tooie has been haunting me in this way since the year 2000. I've never been able to get 100% completion on the Cloud Cuckoo Land level because that one final race with Canary Marie is just plain impossible. Curse you, Canary Mary. Canary Mary, not Canary Marie. Yeah. Anyway, whatever. Ian, go ahead and fire off your answers.
Scruffy, that's pretty much my entire game library. like you brought up Banjo-Tooie. That one I think we just gave up on in general in my household. But for N64 titles, you reminded me, and I haven't thought about this in years, and this is your fault. Diddy Kong Racing, we never finished Mirror Mode because I couldn't do the Silver Coin Challenge in the fourth world, the medieval one. There was just one track where I could not get the coins, and that was it. You could not progress beyond that point. And that...
I managed that, but the Silver Coin Challenge is a nightmare. Absolutely okay. A nightmare, and then Mirror Mode just exacerbates it even worse. It's terrible. It's so bad. I spent months playing that game.
Skies of Arcadia, I've played. It's the only RPG that I've played to completion multiple times, and every time I miss the same treasure chests. I don't know where they are. Like the last time I played through, I made a point of finding it this time, and then there's this weirdo character that you find near the third act, we'll say, last third of the game, who gives you your completion rankings. And every bloody time, I had 88% of the chest. I don't know where it is. I don't know what I missed. It's somewhere out there. And if you joined me on Bumblecast Gaming a few weeks ago, you know that I was stuck on one particular challenge in the story mode. Guess what? Still haven't beaten it.
For what game, Ian?
Team Sonic Racing.
Okay, you didn't say the game.
Oh, well. If you were in Bubblecast Gaming, you would know exactly what I'm talking about, because I can't get that stinking goalpost drifty points thing. I'm bad at cars.
I feel you. I'm just having flashbacks to, like, I don't think I ever completely 100%ed All-Stars Racing Transformed. I managed I managed to unlock Ages, I'm like, okay, I'm good. Now I can just play through the game normally. But it takes forever to just get to unlocking the Daytona car, much less the rest of the game. So Yeah. I just kind of gave up after that. Like, okay, I'm good now. I'm fine. I don't need to worry about it anymore. I have my lovely Daytona car that transforms into an F-14 from Afterburner and a Dreamcast controller boat. I'm good. Otherwise, like, I don't know. I'm pretty casual about games, I guess. I don't get hung up necessarily on having never finished something. Like, the only things I can really think of are games where it was impossible to get 100% anyway. Like, I'm remembering Super Mario World in particular. There are 96 levels in that game, so the most you can get is 96. But at the time, I remember somewhere I saw a screenshot that said, when you first load up the game and you're going through the save games, it counts how many levels you've completed. And somewhere I saw a screenshot of the save screen that said 100% and then had a star next to it. I don't know if that was like just an early version of the game, some kind of thing that got just like a screenshot, that a doctored screenshot or whatever. I remember it being in a book called Mario Mania, which was sort of a basic guide to Mario that covered a lot of Mario World stuff, because Mario World was the game out at the time, but Mario Mania was sort of a history of Mario overall. I remember that being a screenshot in there, I believe, but the most you could get was 96. And I remember getting 96 and being like, all right, where are the last four levels? How do I unlock the last four levels? And it turns out there was no last four levels. It was 96. That was it. Otherwise, the other one I can think of off the top of my head was Gran Turismo 2. There's actually a bug in the game that prevents you from getting complete 100% completion.
What?
Because the game is actually kind of buggy. There was a re-released version of it that you could send in your discs to get a revised disc of it that I never did it. That would actually let you get 100%, and I believe maybe even over 100% because of the way the game calculated completion. But the original release version of Gran Turismo 2, you could never actually get 100%. It was like 99.41 or something like that. It got pretty granular with the percentage completion.
I was about to say.
It was something crazy like that. It might have been even less. It might have been like 98.41 or something. But there was actually a certain bug in that game where if you weren't careful, if you did I believe it was the 100 or 1,000 meter test run, it would actually completely erase your garage.
Oh no.
So every car you owned would just be gone. And if you weren't careful, because this was back in the days when you still had to manually save, you couldn't rely on autosaves. So luckily you could actually get your stuff back just by resetting the game if you accidentally did that. But but if you accidentally saved over your garage with no cars in it, you were screwed. You had to restart the whole freaking game.
Oh my god.
It was bad. It was really bad. So, yeah, Gran Turismo 2 I remember being especially buggy. It's a very buggy game in its original form. So, yeah, that's the only one I can really think of though where it's like I never was able to get 100% on it.
You just reminded me of one more.
Yeah.
Aaliyah and I were playing through Tales of Symphonia, the remaster, mind you, and it had all the additional Japanese content. And in that, Colette got a costume that was Lloyd's, which is adorable on her, except it has an incredibly small window of opportunity to get.
Mm-hmm.
So we were playing up to that point, and it's not anywhere easy to get to in the game. You have to really be a few hours in, and we're trying to keep up with where we are in the game and where it's supposed to be. And it's like, literally, you go to a place, there's a cutscene that gives you control for that one moment, and if you go back to bed, that's it. You've lost your opportunity.
Oh.
You have to take that one opportunity to go to a completely different region of the map to get the trigger. And it's once we missed that, it's like, well, do we even want to play the game anymore? I think that's where we quit.
Oh. Man, that sucks. I really hate like tiny windows of opportunity to unlock things in video games. It's really annoying. Back when I played when before they did some revisions to it, when City of Heroes was actually live and being developed live, I remember there were certain windows of opportunity to get certain badges, and certain badges were required to get certain special powers. So, and this was like achievements. Badges essentially were like achievements. But there were certain windows of opportunity where you could do specific missions, and you have to talk to specific contacts at specific times when you're at certain levels. And if you out-level that contact before you get that mission from them, you're screwed and you're never going back and getting it ever again.
Oh, no.
It wasn't until much later when they added like a flashback system where you could actually go back and do missions you'd missed that you could get it. So if you were... if you didn't realize something even existed until later and you had out-leveled it, it was gone forever. It was terrible. It was a really terrible system, and I hate that in video games. It's one thing that's bugged me. So luckily they added in a way to at least make it so you could get this, the stuff you wanted. But yeah, it was brutal. Brutal! All right, we ready to move on to the next one?
Yep, next. Priority patron queue for... A-ing.
Yes, this one comes from Andrew D. It's a bit of a long one. Any thoughts on the naming conventions of various Sonic robots? In the games, or at least the Japanese games, everything not Metal Sonic was named Mecha Sonic. Then the American games named the Sonic robots from both the 8-bit and 16-bit Sonic 2 games Silver Sonic. Then LEGO Dimensions dubbed the Silver Sonic from 16-bit Sonic 2 as Robo Sonic. Since then, I like to distinguish them as 8-bit Sonic 2 being Silver Sonic, 16-bit Sonic 2 being Robo Sonic, and Sonic 3 and Knuckles being Mecha Sonic. My headcanon was satisfied with that, but then the team behind the mobile app Sega Heroes had a poll to vote on what characters people wanted to see in the game the most, and they referred to each of the three as Mecha Sonic. So what are your thoughts on the names? Have you gotten any feedback from Sega on the matter? If they were ever to appear in the comics, can you state which names you'd prefer to use? P.S. And what about Rocket Metal?
Oh, boy.
See, and Ian?
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, the original release of Sonic CD called Metal Sonic Mecha Sonic.
Yeah, but it also called Amy Sally.
So yeah.
I don't think we have to pay credence to that.
But I've always kind of remembered him as Mecha Sonic, and it wasn't until later that we got him being called Metal Sonic instead. So
right.
Yeah.
Personally, I like the Sonic 2 Big Boy as Silver Sonic.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, almost completely platinum gray.
He's silver,
He looks silver. I prefer the little gangly thing that got a nice callback in Sonic Mania. I prefer that one as Robo Sonic just because it looks so different from all the other mechanical Sonics. I just feel like that makes a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go with you on the Sonic 3 and Knuckles 1 being Mecha Sonic.
Right.
Now, what do you want to define the one from Sonic Adventure? Because it's clearly the Silver Sonic build, but it's not flat gray. It's got all sorts of colors to it and a different design overall. So, but it's not the one. There is no right answer. There was never a right answer. I think it's kind of just redefined as it goes along. As for Rocket Metal, that's completely different. That was built by Tails in Sonic the Fighters, which is a different continuity anyway, because there were 8 Chaos Emeralds, and that's not everything's going to fit. This puzzle does not come from the same box. There are pieces from others. As someone who has spent 12 years trying to cram every single round peg into a square hole, I have come to accept that not everything makes sense, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Everything is canon.
And yet nothing is. And then we also have Mecha Sonic that's actually roboticized Sonic from the early Archie days. So... and now we have Zombot Sonic. Wait, is that a spoiler? Should I have not said that?
He's not a Zombot till he's fully infected.
Okay. Well, he's working on it. He's working on it. So we've got, man, can we get like a robot version of somebody other than Sonic? Can we do
I
that?
I wanted to see a proper Metal Tails for a long time. You're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, a Metal Tails instead of just a Hales doll or whatever. Yeah, none of that crap. an actual
corroborative too.
Yeah, Knuckles. Yeah, like I don't know, Metal Blaze or something. That would be kind of frightening. That would burn quite a bit. All right, let's go ahead and get into the standard Q&A. This one comes from Liam B. Was Sonic and Sally reuniting a personal choice for you, one you felt obliged to do, or one you asked, one asked for by the business? Regardless, thank you for doing it. Did you like them together when you first arrived at the comic? Did you change your mind slowly? What was your thought process to this?
Okay, so quick overview, because I feel like time has muddied the waters.
Mm-hmm.
Sonic, Sad AM, and the beginning of the Archie book up through, the first 100-something issues, Sonic and Sally were the go-to pairing. They had their highs, they had their lows. Amy wasn't really a threat because nobody knew what to do with Amy. She was a little kid off to the side. And there was Jeffrey St. John being a creeper, but mostly it was Sonic and Sally together. Then in Sonic number 134, written by Carl Bowlers, the Sonic came back from space. Everyone thought he had been dead. Nope, he's alive. And Sally tells Sonic that she wants to commit. He's like, I can't do that. And she flips out on him. And I remember reading somewhere that Carl's intention was that while Sally seemed to be the only person with a level head up to this point, she had actually been bottling up all of her issues. And boy, had she been given a lot of issues over the years. And this was the breaking point. Except that was never followed up on. It never actually was utilized as a character trait. So it just seemed to be one moment of Sally snapping at Sonic. And the fandom has never forgiven that one moment, despite the fact that it was resolved and is no longer canon because of the reboot and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I came on the book at 160. So that's what, 2.5 years later?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to do was get Sally back to where she was, which is to say back to the competent, confident leader of the team. So she had to get rid of all her baggage. She had to pave things over with Sonic. They got back to being friends again, which is a very important part of any relationship, I think. I don't think any healthy relationship between anyone, fictional or realistic, is a healthy relationship if you don't have friendship as well as romantic feelings for each other. If all you have is, you know, a lustful or this kind of puppy dog love, it ain't going to last. It's tenuous ground. You're building on a foundation of sand. If you're friends, if there is a level of mutual respect, then it can last. So that's me off my soapbox. Rebuilt the friendship between the two of them. And then what I wanted to do from there was give Sally some options, because Sonic has no options. He cannot settle down. That is from on high. Sonic must be single. Sonic can have interests, but he cannot ever settle down with any one person. So I didn't want to tie that anchor to Sally as well. You know, why should she be restricted by it? She doesn't have the same licensing blinders on. That was one of the great things about the Freedom Fighters, was that we had a whole bunch more latitude to work with them in terms of, you know, where they could go. They could change. They could adapt. They could be affected by things, like when we blew up Antoine. But anyway, so that was part of the reason why I had her kind of hook up with Khan, because Khan needed to be built back up himself, because there was... That was, I think we covered this earlier, is that Monkey Khan was such a bad character and he had so little in terms of meaningful support characters that Sally was kind of like the de facto one to go to. And between the two of them, we built him back up to where he should have been from the get-go. By helping him back to where he should be, Sally kind of found herself again. There was that mutual respect between the two of them. They kind of hooked up. 5 people in the world actually liked the pairing, but I knew that wasn't going to last, because as much effort as I put into that pairing, I knew that wasn't going to be the one that fans were really gaga over. Plus, since they're a world away, you can't really remove Khan from his element, because that defeats the purpose of his story. But if we had Sally, you know, move away from Mobitropolis to be with him, they would burn my house down. No, the fans would not stand for it. So,
yeah. And that's on the just, one that hand, would be kind of her leaving her sort of duty as reclaiming her birthright too.
Right. So, that wouldn't work.
No.
So in a way I felt narratively obligated to bring them back together. But on the other hand, you know, from the get go, you know, go back and read Sonic 160. Sally's first lines to Sonic are about going back to simpler times, and those simpler times were the two of them being friends and being together. So I put a lot of effort into that, rebuilding the romantic angle, rebuilding them as a couple. And then when they were back together, it felt natural. It felt kind of good to see the two of them play off each other again, because they are a fun, odd couple type. They have a neat dynamic.
Yes, they do.
And then, of course, you got roboticized to twist the knife and drive you crazy so you would buy more comics. But that's just me being evil.
Ian, what do you mean the comic business is designed to make money? What are you talking about? I thought you just did this for fun. I thought you did this because you loved it. You jerk. I'm kidding. You do love it, but you've also got to eat. I get it.
Yeah. So to sum it up, too long, didn't read version. It was both something I wanted to do and something I kind of felt obligated to do. Because Sally needed to be restored as a character up to a point, but I didn't want it to be just so that she was with Sonic.
Yeah.
So once she was back to where I thought she would make the decision herself, not because the plot demanded it, but because she was ready to, and because Sonic was ready to, then we put them back together. And I think that made for perhaps an even stronger bond than was at the very beginning.
Yeah. All right. And for those of you out there listening, and I know at least some of you are, please don't go trashing artists for things that were written in comics, especially over a decade after they actually happened. Please don't do that. Please don't. All right. Next question comes from Clay A. In Bubblecast number 88, you said that Cortez wouldn't work in IDW Sonic due to context within Archie. What about Void? Like Cortez, the Archie book was canceled before he could appear. Before it could appear, it seems to be easier to integrate than Cortez. Could it see the light of day?
Maybe. As I said on the previous Bumblecast, the Metal Virus Saga was originally kind of tooled around to be an Archie plotline. And when it was going to fall was going to be around the time Void was... Not Void, Null. Because Void is the Sonic Shuffle character. Null was... the unused one. Null was going to be kind of ancillary to that, and they would have met in the middle somewhere. And we're not doing that with IDW Sonic. So if we were going to revive the concept of Null and how he was going to play into Blaze's backstory and her world, it's a maybe, but I'm in no rush to do that one right now, because Null was kind of more of a backdrop to Bunny's backstory, because that was supposed to be all about Bunny, not so much about Null. And we don't have access to Bunny anymore, so I don't know. It's a maybe. It's a maybe.
Our next question comes from Giovanni Van S. There we go. I think I got it. Would you guys take a peek at my complete fan fiction? It's based from Archie's Sonic number 50, with Sonic suffering from a coma, waking up after 5 years after Robotnik is defeated.
No. Absolutely not. And I do not mean to be mean, but no, I cannot, for legal reasons, look at fan fiction, fan ideas, any of that. I mean, if you draw a picture of Charmy, that's a Sega character. That doesn't count. But if this is your original ideas in the context of their own story, I cannot do that. Because if something happens in the comics down the line that's similar, that would open me up to allegations of, oh, you totally stole this idea for yourself. So I absolutely cannot look at fan stuff. By all means, create as much as you want. Do not stop writing. Do what you want. And I really hope you enjoy it. I hope other folks read it. I hope you get good feedback. But I cannot.
All right. And our last question comes from Active. I'm very impressed with your work so far on the IDW Sonic series, but something has been bugging me. Amy seems a bit like a Mary Sue, suddenly a goddess. I was wondering if it's not too late to really explore what happened between CD and now. I don't really see the goddess aspect of Amy's character.
No. Now, one bit of critique that I can see folks saying is that she seems too much a competent commander on the battlefield. And I think that is somewhat misconstrued, but that's also, I should have worded things a little differently, maybe. My thinking here is that during the Eggman War of Sonic Forces, Knuckles was the commander of the Resistance, but Amy was running the Deinoxys systems, the computers and the files and such. The game establishes this. That's like one of the first cutscenes. Knuckles is not a leader. Okay, he spent most of his life on an island by himself. The fact that he's able to talk to people is impressive. So my thinking was that Knuckles may have given the orders, but Amy was the one who made things actually work. And we kind of toyed with this as the comic started up. Now, as you've seen up to this point, Amy is not 100% confident in what she's doing, but she has to do it. And after spending 6 months telling people what to do during a global war, she's gotten pretty good at it. But as you will see as the book goes on, it's not something that she's comfortable with, and you'll start to see how the strain is starting to wear on her. And we'll be following up on that as Metal Virus continues. I'm thinking Mary Sue as a term is being misused here, because the Mary Sue trope is someone who is flawless. Everyone loves her. Everyone wants to be her. There is nothing wrong with her, and that's not Amy. In her very first appearance, she can't get Sonic to listen to her steadily for 5 minutes. She's not perfectly graceful. She's not 100% on everything. She's certainly competent, but that's after, you know, all this time of adventuring with Sonic. And these are action-adventure characters.
Right.
One of the things I'm not satisfied with game-wise is how Amy just doesn't do much anymore.
No.
I mean, I liked how in Sonic Adventure, she wasn't necessarily a active combatant, but she was still flipping and solving puzzles and jumping. And when she needed to, when Birdie got walloped, she took the fight to Zero. She beat his mechanical... So, I mean, if you've played the games, you already have seen the very, very rough arc that is Amy. She was a clingy fangirl in Sonic CD. She learned some self-reliance in Adventure. She got a little too clingy through Adventure 2 and Heroes. Kind of reached her peak manicness in Battle, and then calmed down ever since. And then became kind of a competent second-in-command-ish character in Sonic Forces. And that's where the comic picks up from there.
See, what's kind of funny...
Which isn't to say that it is a direct continuation of the games. It is not canon to the games. It is his own thing. Whew.
Okay, we got that out of the way. What's kind of funny is, I find interesting about Amy, is that we had originally her first appearance in Sonic CD. When they brought that game over here, she was localized as Princess Sally, and now she has sort of a Sally-esque leadership role, at least in terms of Forces. So it's kind of like it seemed to have brought it kind of full circle, in a way. I hesitate to say that Amy is a proxy of Sally. She's not. She's very different from Sally. But it's just that the way they kind of turned her character into sort of that competent leader type role, I like it. I think it actually works well for her. I like it. I like her in a sort of the... She also serves... She seems to kind of serve as the one who's mainly most down to earth in Sonic Boom. At least as down to earth as that show is allowed to be. She seems to be like the foil for being... I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, Ian. But do you know what I mean? Like, she's kind of. She's kind of the straight man of the group, more so. Not, at least in terms of Boom. She's a bit more even-handed, rather than just being outright ridiculous, like Styx and Knuckles especially are.
Right.
I would say Tails is also a little bit more down-to-earth, but he's also, like, the science guy, so he gets... bogged down by the details and bogged down by like science stuff. So
now what should have happened, and I've said this before, but Vector should have been the commander of the resistance from the get-go. And
right,
that would have been Vector great to pick up from in the comic, but I got to work with what I got.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the games established that Amy was kind of not so much a leader, but more of an administrator.
Right.
And
right.
It wasn't so much that she's leading characters as that she's got the idea of what to do. So she's just shouting that out there and everyone kind of goes with it. Now, when that's put to the test in the Metal Virus Saga, we'll see just how long she can hold out.
All right. That's going to do it. Going to do it for the Q&A and going to do it for this episode of the Bumblecast. Let's give a shout out to the people who support us over on Patreon, Ian.
I think I will.
Okay, let's do it.
A big thank you goes to Daniel H., Eric F., Connell T., Alex P., Andrew D., Blue Title Gamer, Coupling Crew 128, Frederick, Scruffy Matt, Saturn Flicky, Chris A., John B., Jennifer R., Reverend the Light, Lisa M., Duas Diz Din, Dave M., Daniel B., Mike B., Samuel P., Sam Cybercat, Digama F., Wow, Dragon Superfan, Brody M., Neil H., Justin G., Dan M., S., Silly String, DeCaro, Lee H., K., Chevelle, Don B., Sin Fritz, Taco Elgato Comics, John M., James K., Adam B., T., Overthinking Films, and Ron.
All right. Where can the people find you, Ian? Where can they find you on these vast, wide interwebs that we have?
Head on over to BumbleKing.com. That has my con schedule. That has a release schedule for all the books I'm working on, my full portfolio, all sorts of fun stuff. Or over on Twitter, at IanFlynnBKC. What about you, Kyle?
You can find me at KNGI.org, where you can find archived episodes of the Bumblecast and many other shows, including my regular weekly show Nitro Game Injection, which also streams live on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find out more information about how to listen to that over at kngi.org. And you can also follow me on Twitter at KyleJCRB.
Follow the show over on Twitter at Bumblecast. Contact us at bumblecast@yahoo.com or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify.
Don't forget to hit up the Bumble Store to get some Bumble gear at shop.spreadshirt.com/bumblestore.
And catch us every Sunday around 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Bumblecast Gaming Live, where we play a video game for your entertainment. This is open to everyone thanks to the generosity of our wonderful, wonderful patrons.
Yes. And also keep an eye out on the Bumble King Videos YouTube channel for random streams that may just be happening when you happen to tune in, because it can they can happen at any moment. This week especially, we've done a couple things, and we've got some things in the hopper, so keep an eye out. Keep an eye on Twitter for more announcements, too, and also YouTube. You'll see we have them scheduled up there. That's it.
It's going to wrap us up for Bumblecast episode number 96. We are coming within a hair's breadth of Bumblecast number 100.
Oh, boy. That's like 2 months away. Woo-hoo. It's going to be wild. It's going to be wild. It's going to be one heck of a time. So, don't miss it. Don't miss it. We'll see you later.
Have a good night, everybody.
Bye! Okie dokie.
Get all the gross noises out first. Blah, 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 blah.
Nah, we'll never get all those out. Never, ever. I'll never get all of my gross noises out. That's, jeez. You'll have to kill me before they'll be gone. I'll never go away. What is that one game you've been driven nearly to? What is
reboot.
That? Yeah, let's reboot this question. All right, and our next reboot. You've been listening to the Bumblecast, a co-production of Bumble King Comics and the KNGI Network. Original theme music composed by Ken Coda Snyder. Remixed intro by T-Lopes. Find out more information, along with podcast feeder links, MP3 downloads, and more at BumbleKing.com and KNGI.org.
I'm right next to you. I still can't hear you.
Literally, yeah, we would literally be having the same audio issues even if we were in the same room together. It's pretty sad. I can't hear you. We're sitting right next to each other. I can't hear you at all. I can't hear anything. What are you talking about? I'm right here.
Although in that case, odds are even that I'm just messing with you to see how long I can make it go.
Are you doing that?
No, not right now. I'm too tired and cranky for that.
Oh, don't toy with me, Ian.
I'm not. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know if I believe you since you brought it up. Now I know you're capable of it because you brought it up.
Oh, please. You know I'm capable of all sorts of villainy.
This is a good point.